Welcome. Thanks, all of you, for turning up, joining in, listening, doing your commutes. This is the ThoughtWorks Tech Leaders podcast. Today, we're going to be discussing whether or not cloud and microservices are the industry's new silver bullets. My name's Sam Newman. I'm a consultant at ThoughtWorks. I do a bit of writing and a bit of conference speaking as well. And I also have the unenviable task of looking after our internal technical systems. You can follow me on at Sam Newman, or my blog is at samnewman.io. Joining me today for the discussion is Eric Dernenberg. Eric, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi, my name is Eric Dernenberg. I'm head of technology at ThoughtWorks in Europe. I'm based in Germany and I do projects, I consult with our clients, but I'm still looking after the growth of that region.
So we're here to talk about cloud and microservices, which are obviously just universally appropriate tools and technologies in any given situations. So this is going to be a really short podcast, right?
That's what you could believe when you listen to some people. And that's sometimes what you see. It is this, again, this indiscriminate use of technologies that are good for a certain purpose across all sorts of different problem areas where they're unsuitable. And as usual, it is part of the responsibility that we have as a tech industry to understand when to use which technology, because nothing much has changed since the No Silver Bullet paper that was written about 30 years ago, I would say, at this time.
Yeah, it's the Mythical Man Month. I sometimes wish many of the people that brought the Mythical Man Month had actually opened the book and read what was inside it. But it is, it's an easy thing to do, isn't it? You see a presentation by somebody, you adopt somebody else's ideas wholesale, and everything's going to be fine as a result. And that's not really the reality, is it?
Yeah, I guess what I love is that a lot of people are talking about their experiences and they're talking what worked. And they always, and this is not really to criticize people, but everybody is writing, this worked and that worked and it was really cool. And there's always a silent for me, for us. And that is often forgotten. And oftentimes you get the early adopters who are the people who are always on the lookout for new things, finding new things that works for them. They are adopting these, but they have the skills to understand when something works. They can contextualize it.
And they often have a higher tolerance for failure. I mean, they understand they're out on the ragged edge. They understand they're experimenting, that things won't work. Whereas in other organizations, they don't necessarily have that same ability to know when something's not working and to pull out of that investment or whatever else it might be.
And they know that they are searching. They know that they're in a different problem space. I mean, if you look at the Kniven framework, there's these different... I'm not going to go into this in detail. Try to Google it with that pronunciation. It's a Welsh word, if that helps you. They know what quadrant in the Kniven framework they are in, and they know that it's difficult. They know that they are not looking for best practices, that there likely are no best practices. But then as more and more popularity is gained by some of these approaches, people are exactly not only looking for good practices, but for best practices, for instant solutions, rather than puzzle pieces that could be put together.
And that's sort of interesting around the cloud, especially because you do speak to technology leaders and they're going to solve all their problems by, we're going to outsource all of our stuff to a cloud provider. We're going to pick up our internal infrastructure, which is very expensive, and we're going to stick it on an external cloud provider, and that's it. My problems are going to be solved. And that doesn't really work very well, does it, for many people?
Yeah, but I mean, maybe we can talk about the good aspects for a second here. And I mean, to be honest, I mean, we'll probably talk about microservices, given that you are in this conversation sooner or later. But what we really saw is with the rise of DevOps that was tackling a real problem, we were completely overloading a lot of teams that were trying to do DevOps in their own data centers because, I mean, it is difficult enough to be a full-stack developer. It's probably for a whole different podcast episode. But then to extend it into knowing the intricacies of which fiber channel to use and which switch is better in which mode is just something that doesn't make sense anymore. So I do think that it is actually, in a certain degree, a great solution for the DevOps issues that we saw, that teams were completely stretched with the public, especially public cloud offering. We, at least I have seen with the projects and the clients that I'm working with, actual real DevOps, where everybody in the team was doing similar work and they were maintaining and creating the solutions from beginning to end.
And that does seem to be the secret with those cloud offerings. It's the ones that give you that right level of abstraction. Like the at the infrastructure as a service level of, say, off-premise cloud, you do have a plurality of providers out there that have a fairly sensible abstraction over the underlying compute, allowing you to, as you say, you don't have to know about the switches and the firewalls. You still have to know about machines and storage, but that's still an easy thing for most people to get their heads around, most developers to get their heads around. Of course, things start getting a little bit more tricky at the other types of cloud offerings out there and the different platforms that are available. And just keeping up with something like Amazon's product offerings is like a full-time job.
Yeah, but you make a good point. And we started early on with these categorizations of infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, and software as a service. I don't think we're going to talk about the latter today, but it almost seemed there are binary that you had to categorize something as either platform as a service or infrastructure as a service. And I think what we're seeing now is on that silver bullet trail, we're seeing now the experimentation, what the right level is. And I firmly believe now, after I've seen a good bit of this, that it's somewhere in between what was called platform as a service and infrastructure as a service. I would call them platform services. So you do want to have a database and not know how it's set up. You just want to store things. But you don't want, in most cases at least, I mean, if we are talking about the good practice and easy or broadly applicable solutions, what you want is you want individual things you can plug together, maybe not even have to worry about how to set up a Cassandra ring. But at the other, on the other side, you maybe don't want to have a fully baked solution like, and I'm going to single out Google App Engine here or Heroku, which for smaller applications makes sense, but generally for the larger endeavors that our clients are undertaking seem to be a bit too restrictive.
Yeah, and that's sort of an interesting problem. I mean, I think Amazon haven't done a very good job, I don't think, with their own offerings in that space yet. So there definitely seems to be growth in that middle tier. Heroku's still the best of the platforms as a service that I've seen out there. But we haven't been able to mimic that on-premise. I mean, you talk here about public cloud. Many of our clients are trying to do stuff in private cloud, and there the world seems a lot more difficult and a lot more confusing. The quality and ease with which you can, the quality of final product and the ease of setting up is much higher. I mean, have you seen clients, our own clients, have they actually been able to successfully implement internal cloud in general?
I wonder sometimes why they're even trying. I think the one way, and now we're getting to the microservices, I think one of the major reasons people are trying it is when they want to implement microservices or some shape of service-oriented architecture. I mean, at this point, it's probably important to contextualize this. And our colleague Martin has a really nice Venn diagram, and he shows service-oriented architectures. And microservices are completely inside service-oriented architectures. They are not a radical departure. They are just, I often joke and call them SOA done right. So this is not something that arrived completely new. It was just something that suddenly made a lot of sense to practitioners and thus gained more and more adoption. But at the same time, microservices are not easy to operate. It is actually harder to operate a whole set of, I don't know, 50 or 80 microservices than one monolithic application. And I think when we get to that point, then there's a drive in the organization to have something like a cloud offering where provisioning is easy, where elasticity is there, where there's metered costs, all these characteristics of clouds. But then as many, and you asked about the clients, and that's why sometimes then you have internal operations departments and are saying, no, we can't really go to the public cloud. And then there's a long list of reasons why you can't do it. And then say, and you know what? It's actually not that hard. We're going to build an internal private cloud.
It's not that hard, which has proved to be wrong many times. I mean, OpenStack has definitely made that easier, but it's still, for example, a significant investment to deploy that locally on your own infrastructure. And is probably going to be significantly more expensive as well because, you know, you're running your own machines, you're still going to buy and provision them. I think you're right, though, that certainly to make microservices work, you do need the ability to provision that sort of middle tier more easily. And again, I think you talked about microservices being SOA done right, which I think is completely appropriate because we had these ideas 10, 15 years ago, but there was so much friction in the environment that we're operating in that it really wasn't possible for us to implement those ideas. Public cloud made that possible, and now we've got people that have internal systems that can't be moved, maybe for privacy reasons, maybe because you've already got a sunk cost in physical hardware. But the microservices themselves, even once you've got that lovely platform in place, aren't necessarily you know, a free lunch, are they, right? I mean, they can be great once they're up and running, but getting to the point where you can manage them well can take a significant investment.
Yeah, and at that point, it is quite difficult and very difficult because there are so many different organizational trajectories that get you to that point, that is to come up even with good practices or in perfect path of how to get there. And people sometimes, and I've seen this, that people are saying, we're stumbling into this. But I wouldn't even say this is stumbling. I think this is a very agile approach. You're just beginning to start. And one thing that you hear people talk about is this idea that you can set up a new microservice within, and then any arbitrary number, 15, 20 minutes, from nothing to something that is fully operational in production. And yes, that is possible. And some of our colleagues who are working on the more mature microservices architectures have actually done this. But that's not where you start. When you're beginning to work with microservices, it's not the first thing. You're not setting up a stencil or tailored service template and then start building. This whole big design upfront is biting a lot of organizations. I think we've overcome this a lot, and we have switched more to evolutionary architectures. But now when something, and it's often obviously seen as big stake, when something with these big stakes is coming up to say, we split the monolith after 20 years, that people want to do it right, and then they feel they have to do all this upfront work, and they read a lot, and then they agonize for weeks in architecture boards about how that service template can look like and what all the macro architecture constraints are. And I think we should unwind there and really start small, find a few services, evolve our way into something like this.
And it's sort of interesting. I mean, I wrote a book on microservices and spent a lot of time talking to companies that did this stuff. And, you know, REA in Australia is one example of this. And if you look at them as a point in time now, they have hundreds of services, more services than developers. And, you know, they certainly spent a lot of time decomposing those older legacy or heritage systems. But the reality is, a lot of those systems they started decomposing are still there. They sort of defanged them. They are doing fewer things, but that they have been on that journey for many, many years. It's not a, yes, as you say, it's not an upfront exercise. It's more like, I'd liken it more to chipping away bits of marble. You start off with this big thing and you try and make it a little bit smaller, and then you see how that went. You understand the difficulty of managing more deployed services. You invest some time in reducing the transaction cost of spinning a new service up, and you chip away a bit more. And it is a gradual, incremental thing. I almost wonder with some of the organizations that in the past had larger monolithic systems, their pace of change was quite slow. It took so long to get anything done. The decision-making cycles are much longer. That doesn't necessarily prepare them for a more evolutionary, flexible, agile approach to architecture.
And I guess it is exactly about where you spend your time. And this is where a big distinction, or where I think microservices are quite distinct in that world of service-oriented architectures, in that the focus is actually on the implementation of the actual services and not so much around on the surrounding infrastructure. And in the big failure, I think, or why service-oriented architectures in general didn't deliver on the many promises that were made, was, again, this focus on the centralized technologies, especially something like enterprise service buses, but also complicated registries, controlling standards with interface specifications that were really iron cast and so on. This real focus on the things in between the services rather than the services themselves, because people felt they had to get this right for this to scale. And I think what we're seeing with microservices is if you organize your teams and you make the architectural decisions by people who are normally and first and foremost working in teams, you get a focus on the service and what it needs to live. And that's actually quite a bit already, to be honest, and we can talk about that maybe in a minute. But the focus really is on the service. What evolves is the business architecture, the landscape of your services, and all the things in between the services, they are a necessity. But they are only done because you have to do them, not because you feel you must do a lot of work there.
It is emergent. I mean, all the people that talk about their fantastic microservices successes made mistakes along that journey. They got service boundaries wrong. They got technology wrong along that path. And you take an incremental step. Gilt, who have gone from this monolithic Rails application to this sort of microservices world, that took them a long time, and they share the graphs of their services, their service decomposition. They started off with one thing, which is their Rails app, and then they had like two or three for like many months, and then they had four or five. They've now got like this huge explosion has happened, but that was like 3 years of just solid learning and experimentation, and actually, as you said, having the teams empowered. And it does seem to me that microservices, when they are done right, are all about empowering teams. They're all about autonomy. And it does sort of lead itself to having different ownership models. You know, having teams actually owning a service rather than, say, you know, having a giant code base open to everybody.
Guilt is a good example, though. Guilt is a good example here for another thing that I think is really important with microservices. And that is a certain level of confidence of knowing that you may fail at some point, but to have the confidence to go with what will work for you rather than chasing arbitrary goals. And there's an interesting presentation that Adrian does from Guild. And one thing that stuck with me was a histogram that shows the average length of a microservice in lines of code. And we all know that lines of code don't necessarily correlate with the function implemented, but I mean, there's some interesting thing in here. And microservices, while I think a lot of things are right with the name, also that it is not a three-letter acronym, so it reminds you of what it stands about, and you can't do something like an SOA architecture and all these other excesses that we've seen. But the micro in there sometimes drives people, and if you are just chasing, and if you're trying to just emulate without really understanding, at some point you hear people saying, we have microservices that are just 10 lines of code. And these are often done as extreme examples by organizations that have maybe 80, 90, 100 microservices. But suddenly then people think the less lines of code, the more microservice we are. And that is lacking the confidence to say, no, actually, you know what? This service is okay to have 1,000 lines of code. It makes sense from a business context to have this functionality. It is difficult, and we have the confidence to say this is right. We are not chasing these abstract goals. We are really here to deliver business functionality in the best possible way. But it takes a lot of confidence to do that in the light of a lot of the blogging that is out there and all the information and all the drive towards extremes.
You have to feel it's okay not being like somebody who's a fashion retailer when you're an investment bank, for example. I mean, I think it's the whole, oh, we're going to copy everything that Netflix does, which is great if you are a video streaming company that gobbles up like 20% of the internet bandwidth. I mean, I talk about microservices as a dial, as a slider. There are extremes, and you take that dial and you sort of crank it up gradually until the pain is more than the benefit, and then you crank it back a little bit. But it is an ongoing, gradual progression. We should probably wrap up now. Have you got any other thoughts you want to share before the end?
Just to answer the question, are they silver bullets? Yeah. Obviously not. But are they exciting technologies that allow people to do what they couldn't have done before? Absolutely.
Thanks, Eric. Thank you for listening.